Hello and welcome to a special edition of Chalk Talk. Today we've got Second World War rifleman Victor Gregg talking about his long and varied career in the war and beyond. He's in conversation with Rick Stroud.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rick Stroud. I'm a writer and a film director. Peter assured me that but when we came to start, the bangs would stop, and I thought that was a bit of a pity because it would give verisimilitude to the whole thing if we were a bit under fire as we're talking, as Vic has been all his life. I first met Vic about 7 years ago. Vic is 97, aren't you, Vic? And I first met him 7 years ago when I was researching what it was like for a soldier to live in the Western Desert, for a desert rat. And I was introduced to Vic, and Vic, after, first of all, not, I think, didn't really trust me, because when I arrived at Winchester, where he lives, he said, "I'll meet you at the station." I got to the station, there was nobody there. And then after about 10 or 20 minutes, I saw that up the road there was a car that suddenly flashed its lights, and that was Vic. And he just checked me out before making contact with me, and that is the action of an old spy, which is what Vic has been. Anyway, he came to trust me that day, and he gave me the manuscript that he'd written for his grandchildren, one of whom is here with his daughter, about his life. And he gave it to me, and I gave it to a friend of mine who was an editor at Bloomsbury. And the result was that we published a book together, which Vic had written and which I helped to edit and bring it into the world, called Rifleman. And from that, we then published another book called King's Cross Kid. And from that, we published another book called Soldier Spy. So Vic Gregg, at the age of 97, has published a trilogy of books, a man who left school when he was 14 with no... Four e-book. Books. Oh, yes, we've done four, because we did an e-book about Dresden. Four books! So what I'm going to do is just talk to Vic and talk with Vic through his life. Sometimes he'll get cross with me because I'm going to stop him and make him stick to the point that I want him to stick to. If we get the time, I will try and get some questions at the very, very, for the last 10 minutes or so. So I'm going to start now by asking you, Vic, and welcome here to this battlefield. Just tell us a bit about your early life in King's Cross.
Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, my early life is, it was early. I was brought up in a probably one of the most deprived areas of London, around King's Cross, where people used to take the front doors off and burn them to keep them warm in the winter. Yes?
You're...
Yeah, is it? I'll hold it. Is that okay?
Yeah,
it's okay. What are you talking about? Anyway, you'll have to excuse me because I might use terms accidentally which might offend a couple of people. Like when I say, oh God, I've bloody got a couple of them now. When I went to school, all the kids, they had no socks, or they had their arse hanging out of their trousers. You had a bit of cardboard in the bottom of your shoes to keep the water out. Anyway, it was hard. And of course, my old man, he fled the coop when my sister was born. That was 6 years after me. We never saw any more of him. And so my mum had to bring us all up, go to work in a doing what she'd done, and it was real hard in them days. I don't know what I'm supposed to talk about, really.
I
can't say anything what Dickens hadn't said already.
No, but Vic, the point about you is that you're 97, you're one of the few people who remembers what it was like around King's Cross to be born into a very poor...
Well, there were no cars. The kids used to play in the street, and if you was playing cricket... Football's all right, because you only had a ball made out of newspaper with a bit of string. But cricket was a bit dangerous because you was always breaking the windows. And every street had its gang.
That's it, Vic.
Every street had its gang. You know, I'd was in a Wakefield Street gang. There was Harrison Street gang round a corner, Sidmouth Street gang further up the road. And we was all bashing the hell out of each other at the slightest opportunity. And then the three gangs would combine if we was invaded by another gang from King's Cross who thought they was... That's what life was like, not only in London, but I presume in every big capital city in Europe, because that's what life was like in them days. It was hard. Education was minimal, but at the same time, I consider that my education up to 14 was almost as good, if not better, than a lot of the young children are coming out of school at 14 today. Although, I haven't got an Oxford accent yet, and never going to have one. But at least I don't say yeah, I say yes. That was obviously brought up to do that.
Enough about your elocution.
Yeah, it's keeping me on the track.
Vic, just talk about when you left school. What sort of work did you do as a young 14-year-old, 15-year-old?
I left school at 14. So you go up the Labour Exchange, which was atop of Pentonville Road, and they direct you to gainful employment. In my case, it was an optician in Exmouth Street Market. And he was a German, but he was in collaboration with a Welshman. So what we had to do as youngsters... You get a bench, and then you've got a little sort of thing coming up through the platform, and then you had these strips of Bakelite or whatever, and you had to mill them out to make a spectacle frame. No guards or anything, so the kids they were always cutting their fingers off, so there was always always somebody handy with a bowl of water, and we used to have a bucket of distemper to brush out the blood, and then they had a taxi service which used to take the kids to the Royal Free Hospital. Nobody thought anything about that. And then when you reach about 16 and you start thinking you want to have a bit more money, then the governor would sack you and take another bunch of 14-year-olds on. But there was nothing unusual in that in them days. That's what it was all about.
And what were they sort of... You played with street gangs when you were a child, and then you got involved with gangs in Soho, didn't you, when you were a teenager?
After the first years, one time I was 16, I was in... One of our chiefs... methods of getting some income, like all the gangs who used to run the girls around King's Cross and Soho, where I lived, because we moved from Compton Street in King's Cross to Erbrand to Kenter Street, right by Russell Square. So I was right on the edges of Bloomsbury then, and all the arty crafters and all those sort of people, and they'd all folksy wokesies, they were all round there, including the girls. And we used to get a certain amount of income from the Ponces. You say, look, all you got to do, when you see the coppers come round, tell the girls, and they can go in the fish shop, and they're in the fish shop, and then tell them when the coppers are gone, and they give you sixpence a week for that. So that was a good thing. That wasn't bad.
So you'd had, apart from sort of skirmishing in Palestine, you'd had no experience of fighting?
No, what you had experience of, you had experience of... stuff going, you could hear it go by, you know, like ones and twos, a burst here and a burst there. It didn't really mean anything, but it was good training, because at least when it really happened, we were prepared for it as a regiment, as a battalion.
And then when did it sort of start to get real, Vic? Was it a bit of form or...?
Well, we had the early campaign under Wavell, and we ended up at Biedefon, and that was really where it really hit home, at Biedefon. Biedefon is not well known. It happened in 1940, but it was the first victory of the British Army, and this smaller contingent, about 600 of us, marched across the desert. Well, we didn't march, we was in trucks, to this road, which was round the Gulf of Surtees, and cut the whole of the retreating Italian army off. 600 men and a couple of batteries of the 4th RHA, and there was a few tanks, not many, which came along about a day later. And we captured the whole of the British, of the Italian army. But it wasn't easy, it lasted 2 days. And the dead ones, everything in front of us was dead bodies. So, that was our first
Blooding or initiation?
Initiation into what was going to come in the future.
And you told me, Vic, that that was the first time that you took part in hand-to-hand fighting.
Yeah, they actually got their tanks actually got amongst us, and the 25-pounders were firing at them over open sights at somewhere around about 50 yards. But eventually it became too much for them, and they put their white flags up and it stopped. That was after 2 days. And it was a rifle brigade captain who took their surrender. And that was the first victory the British Army had in the hostilities since it started.
That was a rifle brigade, I think it was a captain, who took the surrender of something like 30,000 Italian soldiers. But I just want to press you on this, that when I say it got real, there was hand-to-hand fighting, wasn't there, Vic? Was that the first time you'd killed somebody close up?
It was unusual in the fact that I never actually came in like to that closeness of actual sort of eyeball to eyeball until I got to Arnhem, and there was times at Arnhem when that was replicated, when you was almost instead of firing at each other, you was punching each other or hitting each other with sticks. In my case, they hit me with a rifle. One bloke hit me with a rifle butt, a German, smashed all the front of my face. But I wasn't even walking wounded. I could still fire a gun.
Okay, but we'll come to Arnhem in a minute. Bede Fomm was followed by Alamein, wasn't it? And you were in the first advance of Alamein.
Alamein was a stalemate until one incident. Montgomery had got himself in a position facing this German army, which was dug in. And of course, you get all these talks, they come around and say, oh, it's going to be easy, it's going to be, it's going to be a cakewalk. Anybody who's got any experience of fighting the Germans, nothing, never going to be a cakewalk, never. And so there's a lot of lads, we lost a lot of lads at Alamein. And of course, we was involved in they called us out one night. And are we still there? Yeah, we are. And so we go on this patrol. It's supposed to be a battalion patrol, and we get this place called Snipe Ridge. And we was about 2 miles in front of the British. By the time we got there, we was 2 miles in front of the British Army lines and well inside the German lines. But of course, this was midnight. And the colonel, when we got there, he came out with the usual words that a rifle brigade colonel would come out with. He said, well, here we are and here we stop. Simple as that. So that's what we did. And we lasted about 18 hours. Rommel lost about 60 tanks. Rommel was unable after that battle to land to do anything really with his armour, because we'd more or less killed it all off. We had these new 6-pounder guns, which after 3 years at last we had something which we could deal with. At last we had a weapon after 3 years which could actually put the Germans out of action. And that was it. As far as tanks was concerned, as far as we was concerned, we wasn't worried about tanks anymore once we got the 6-pounders.
And what Vic hasn't said is that when they stopped at Snipe in the night, and when they woke up in the morning, they found that they were right in the middle of all these German tanks, and that's why they had to fight them, and they were in a sort of Alamo situation. And there was a VC one at that action, and there's a famous painting of the gunner on the last six-pounder gun being reloaded by his commanding officer, a guy called, is he called Vic Turner, who won the VC there. Some people, including me, think that the gunner should have won the VC. But you lost friends in Arnhem, in the desert, didn't you, Vic? What about Frankie
Batt?
Yeah,
I lost one of my mates who joined up with me, who was on the train to Winchester, a lad named Frankie Batt, and he came on Bulls Pond Road, which is in the east end of London, and he got blown to smithereens. And it was about 40 or 50 yards away from me at the time. So I rushed over, tried to put him together again. I was demented then, absolutely demented. I don't know whether I was foaming at the mouth, but to see Frankie sitting like that, all blown to bits. The only way he got out of it is the sergeant, the bloke named Cunningham, Ted Cunningham, another mate of mine, he gave me a right-hander and knocked me cold, and they carried me back, got me back to the lines again. And what I was going to do, I was going to jump in his bleeding carrier and I was going to go for the Germans, all guns blazing. Of course, I wouldn't have lasted more than about 50 yards. But that when you're in a situation like that, you don't think about that because you don't know what you're doing. You're crazy.
Vic, just describe in more detail what happened with Frankie.
Frankie was in his truck. Frankie was in a different company than me. I was in a company called C Company. Frankie was in B Company. And Frankie was driving a 1500 weight full of mortar bombs, already primed, ready for the lads, because B Company were doing a little stint right in the front. The front wasn't a mile away. Front was only about 100 yards away. But that was considered a front line there. And we was in the rest period, 100 to 200 yards behind. And that was a rest period, see, because although the shells could reach her, the 303 and the bullets and stuff like that couldn't reach her. So that was a rest period. And Frankie drove off to his company lines, and he got about halfway between the two of us, and we watched his truck blow up sky high. And that was Frankie in it. And I got over it, of course I got over it.
But you thought, Vic, that he was all right, didn't you? Because he was still sitting in the truck.
Yeah, he was sitting in the truck, see? So first thing I do, I try to pull him out the truck, because the truck's all light. And so I tried to get him out, and as I pulled him out, the bottom half of him dropped all over my feet. It all sounds a bit nasty, and it was nasty, but I don't know how to talk about things like that, but he was in two halves, so I pulled the top half out, and the bottom half slid on the floor. And that's what probably sent me demented. That knocked me crazy a bit, but I got over it. I got over it after about two or three weeks, and I was just the same then. Frankie, I lost a lot of friends, actually, not mates.
And then, Vic, you spent a little bit of time with the Long Range Desert Group driving wounded soldiers about, and then you went to Italy and you had a bit of a breakdown. What happened in Italy?
Well, when I went to Italy, when we got to Cape Bon, when it was all over, and they wanted to send the battalion back to the Middle East, and I didn't want to go back. I didn't fancy going back to some rest camp up on the Suez with all the ball that would be there. So they come around asking for volunteers for this newly formed parachute brigade.
No, but Vic, talk about your breakdown in Italy.
So anyway, we get into Italy. They send us to Italy. We go to Italy, so. And it was we was on the west on the east side of Italy, and all the bad stuff was going on the east side. So we had it fairly comfortable, really. Yeah, still getting killed, but it was easier than what the lads were having on the other side. But I was going along one day, and I realised that. I was hearing shots, and I was falling on the ground, dropping down on the ground. So now I thought to myself, well, you know, there's something wrong here. And so I went out to the sergeant who was in charge of us. I said, you bet, because I had a Vickers, I was on the Vickers machine gun. I said, I says, I told him that I thought that, I'd lost it. I'd lost it. So, and by luck, this sergeant, who was in the Devon, he was in the Devon regiment, and he more or less sussed out what had happened to me. What it was, that I'd been so used to combat on the Western Desert, where you could see the Germans about 2 miles away, lighting a fag, because everything was so flat. Here, you had, it's like the lads in Normandy. You'd be going along through a forest, and the enemy would be behind a bush, and you wouldn't see them, about 10 yards away. They'd lob a grenade at you. And the first thing you know, you was in amongst the enemy when a grenade landed at your feet. And not, and that, so, yeah, that, I had a breakdown here, shell, bit of shell shock. So he said to me, he said, well, that's all right, Vic, he says, and the vicar's over, give it another blow. He says, you get the end of the back of the column, he says, and go back for a few weeks or a few days until you feel better, which I did. I mean, if I'd been in the guards or anything like that, that'd have probably shot me for cowardice. But these people were a little bit in advance of the guards. And after about, he's right, because after 3 weeks, all of a sudden I realised that I wasn't dropping to the ground anymore and that I wasn't worried. I was back to my old devil monkey, you know, don't give a monkeys sort of state. And so I goes up, I said, I'm all right now. He says, you sure? I says, yeah. So, okay, take over the vicars again. And that was it. So I went through that. I come out of that. I was lucky in so much that I had a sergeant in charge of the platoon who really knew what it was all about. He'd been through it. He knew what it was all about. He saw the trouble and he rectified it.
And so you were all right, and that was the first sign that battle could have any effect on you. Then you joined the parachute regiment, didn't you? What? Just describe that, Vic. What happened?
Well, you come back to came back to England because they wanted us for the second front. So, when I come home, I got married. And it was lovely, wonderful, peace, God, bloody hell, it's lovely it was. So what am I good doing sticking up in this camp, up in the Midlands, when my Frieda is down in London? All I've got to do is get on a train and have a good time. See, which I've done a few times. And finally they nobbled me and brought me back and sent me up to Sowerby Bridge, where there was a glass house, 28 days. For being absent without leave, and I only done about 2 weeks because that was the 6th of June, so they pulled us out on the 3rd of June, straight down to Cottesmore on the airfield. So we land on the airfield, nothing happens, and then the 6th of June, we're still on the airfield. They haven't used us, so we wonder what's going to happen. So about the 8th of June, they loaded us all in the planes, and they was going to drop us over. I don't know where it was, somewhere around about Colne. And then we get halfway over the channel and they pull us all back because where we're going to drop, the Germans are there, see? And then they done it again. They were going to drop us in a place called the Falais Gap. And then halfway over again, the same thing happened. They brought us back again. By that time, about 25 blokes in the battalion, they were useless. They were absolutely nervous wrecks after that. But I didn't worry about that. For some reason, it didn't bother me.
Keep your own.
I thought I was on holiday.
Yeah. Just before we get to Arnhem, just describe how you were recruited into the parachute regiment. The guy saying you could all have a holiday, or something.
Yeah. Well, we're all sitting down because the hostilities are over. See. So we're all wondering what's going to happen next. And then they come round, and the colonel comes round, and he's got this sort of bully beef box, and he pulls it out, stands on top of it, and gather round, lads, gather round, you know, the old bull, and as if we're his children and he's God. But he was a good bloke anyway. So he's got to tell us that he doesn't agree with it, but the powers up high, they want 20 men out of the battalion as volunteers for this parachute regiment. They've gone around the whole of the 7th Armoured Div, and they were taking so many people out of each unit. So he asked for volunteers, and nobody stepped forward, naturally. Who's going to throw themselves out of an aeroplane? You've got to win nutcases, see? So then he says, well, because there's no... Another geezer got up then, and he said, if you volunteer, and this is the truth, I mean, they're so stupid. Well, they're not really. If you volunteer, you'll go down to Tel Aviv, and you'll have some basic training, and then you'll have 2 weeks leave, and then if you don't like it, you can come back up. So it took about, I think at the most, about 10 seconds, and everybody in the regiment stepped forward. Because they wanted the 2 weeks leave, and mind you, we've been on the desert 3 years, and to come out with a thing like that. So then they took the names out of that anyway, and I was one of the poor sods who got picked. And so that's how I joined I didn't volunteer to throw. I wasn't sort of a brave hero. I was just looking for a 2 weeks leave in Tel Aviv.
Just describe the technique that you had for landing with your parachute, which were, you know, the business of.
They had all these techniques for landing. You had to, you know, you drop, you got your feet and knees together, and you are going, oh, that's it. And then, because by that time, those of us who had joined out of the Rifle Brigade, we'd had 3 years of it. So nobody's going to tell us how to keep alive in a combat situation. So we come, they were going to drop us over the Suez Canal. Over the bit of lakes, which is part of the Suez Canal, and it's not too deep. So they're going to drop us over the bit of lake to teach us how, to give us experience of jumping in the water. So up we go. We land over the bit of lakes. Sure enough, we're about half a mile off course and nearly in the middle of the Suez. So it looks down. So the first thing I've done, I'm halfway down. Bang, I hit the button. And then I'm hanging on to the chute like that, see? I'm free of it. So when I get about 10 feet from the water, I let go. The chute sails on, and I'm in the water. I'm all right. And so we had a discussion on this, the lads, when we got back. And so it was decided that that's what we were going to do. And the colonel had us up. He said, as long as I don't see you doing it, you know, sort of thing. Well, where are you going? You won't see us doing it. You're in another plane. You're with all the big wigs. So, but we're going to keep alive. Which really saved me at Arnhem, because when I dropped at Arnhem, by that time we'd perfected it, and I had this big 60-pound bag. You had a big kit bag full of grenades and stuff like that, ammo, food. And this was tied with a lanyard to you, besides all the other stuff you're carrying. So you jump out. So that's the first thing I've done. As soon as I was airborne, because we jumped from about 450 feet, as soon as I was airborne, give it about 10 seconds, bash, crash, and you're free. So when I landed, on top of all the dead boys who had landed the day before, the whole of the DZ was littered with dead bodies. The lads who dropped, because we dropped on the second day, and they were all dead, and there's all this stuff coming up at us, tracer stuff like that. Anyway, I hit the button, drops down, and I see the chute floating. You know, it's going away from me, followed by all this tracer. But I was all right because I'm on the ground and I'm stretched out lower than a snake's belly. So, you know. And eventually you make it to the centre of the DZ where all the lads are gathering, and you've got to open the containers, and then you've got to get the stuff out of the containers off the DZ. Then you've got to find out where the battalion is forming up, what's left of them, and it goes on from there. A lot of the lads, of course, didn't make it. I think out of the 450 that dropped, I think there was about 200 of us who made it to the edge of the drop zone. And on the second day, there was only eighty of us left standing. That's what it was like at Arnhem.
And how long did that go on for, Vic, the fighting?
Oh, well, I was part of a machine gun section, the Vickers. So I didn't go charging over anywhere, not with a Vickers machine gun. They tell you, right, you sit, put the tripod down there, put the gun on it, and you cover that area there, see? That's the job of a defensive Vickers machine gun group. So that's probably why I'm still alive today. But we get in this position eventually where they come around and tell us that they're going to try and get across the river that night, and they'll let us know when we've got to leave. So about 11 o'clock that night, we've run out. We've got no more ammo left, so we had an officer with us. There was about eight of us all together in the group. There was one three-inch mortar, my Vickers, and some riflemen. So we run out of ammo. So the officer says, I'm going to go back to you and find some more ammo, which he crawls away on his belly to try to get some more ammo. And he comes back about 5 minutes. There's nobody there. He said, they've all gone. He said, we're surrounded by Germans. Oh, dear. So, to be honest, although you might not believe it, I wasn't aware that any of the lads I was with was worried about their future. They were still ready to fight on, although they had no ammo. This is the amazing thing about it. We had no ammo. We were starving hungry because we'd been 6 days at it. We were soaking wet because it was pelting down with rain. And yet, all of my time in the British Army, I've never seen people pray. And the only time they pray is when the padre comes up before you go into battle and says, right, oh lads, and God help you and God save the king, and I wish you luck, lads.
God help you.
But we all know, because we've seen it, that a mile and a half away, there's a German bloke in a German army telling these blokes exactly the same tale. So you take it, yeah.
So you...
I, it's not like the films where you see you see men crying and clutching their rosaries and praying and calling out. I have seen a German, young German kid crying for his mother. That was at Arnhem. He was laying in the road. He was in uniform, young German, and he was in a right state. Nobody shot him. We just left him in the road. He was crying out for his mum. And mudder, see? And so I got captured there. They put me in the nick.
And just to when Vic says he was safe on the Vickers, the Vickers man by three people, Vic was number one, so he's sitting up behind it, firing it, and there's a bloke feeding the ammo and there's a bloke looking after the water. You lost 12 men on that Vickers, didn't you?
Yeah, well, some stroke of luck. I mean, really, I ought to be a great believer. Because it's me, I'm number one on the Vickers. Anybody in the army, anybody of you lads who have been in the army, knows full well that if you're sitting behind a machine gun on a tripod, you're sitting upright. And you've got you're looking through there and you've got your finger. But the lads who are feeding the belt, and the other lad on the other side of you, they're lower than the snake's belly. Because there's no reason for them. But they were the blokes who got killed. For some reason or other, and I went through about four different crews, actually, and I still didn't have a scratch. And the only thing I had was it was about the fifth day when this German belted me. We were quite close together. We was all mixed up together. And I suppose there was about 100 of us all fighting each other. And this German bashed this Mauser rifle, bashed it in my face like that, and broke all my teeth and made a right old mess, but I shot him. So I got away with that, all right. But
and
I didn't give any money. I didn't worry about it all that much.
Let's now move on, Vic, to to where you did start to worry. You're a prisoner of war, and you're working in that soap factory. Keeping you up, Vic, am I?
Yeah. What happened? They catch you, and then they ask, and you go in these big camps like 4B, where there's thousands of British soldiers. They've been in there since Dunkirk, some of them. And they're waiting to be relieved, waiting for the victorious Allies to come and get them out. And I couldn't see the sense in that. So I volunteered for this Arbeitslager, which is a working camp. So, yeah, okay, go down there. You go down to Dresden. And I went to this little place called... began with Ness, anyway. So it's south of Dresden, about 4 mile outside in the suburbs, and what you had to do is, in the winter, they put you out in the fields picking up the turnips or cutting up the cabbages, or you'd be on emptying the coal out of the trucks, anything like that, sweeping the streets, keeping the streets. No war work. There was no war work. So, yeah, okay, we've got to get away from here. So it's four of us. And we decide that we're going to save up every crust of bread we can, and we're going to make go out. Because Czechoslovakia was only about 40, 50 miles away. So we thought we're going to go down there and get away to Switzerland. This is the middle of winter when the snow was 2 feet on the ground. I mean, if we'd had any sense, we'd have known from the start we wasn't going to make it. But, eventually we got captured again, and so the bloke in charge of the camp, he decides to punish me. So, but the punishment was not actually working in the soap factory. It was a 6 kilometre walk there and back in the morning and the night through the snow. So he gave me a pair of clogs so I'll be able to walk through the snow. So we get to this soap factory. And they had no fat in Germany, so the soap was made out of pummy powder. The sort of stuff what battleship, they give the sailor like a big hunk of it, and they scrub the battleship deck with it, bring it up white. Pummy powder. And it's the same colour as cement. And these Italians are on the other side of the shed building a wall. And they've got a big pile of cement. And we've got a big pile of pummy powder. So they've got this enormous, great wheelbarrow, which we have to fill up, me and Harry, who I was working with, you have to fill up and march it along and then empty it in this big sort of mixer, which was going round all day long. So Harry, he was a nutcase. He says, he come from Yorkshire. And he said, come on, Vic, he says, we'll fill it up with cement and see what happens. So we've done that with two of these big barrel loads of cement went into this mixing machine. And this was about 4:30 in the afternoon, and it was the last load. And the bloke in charge, the German, he couldn't make out why the mixture wasn't getting soft, getting hard, you know. It was full of water. Of course it wasn't, it was cement. It wasn't pummy powder. So he said, we'll leave it till tomorrow morning. So At the time, I didn't think anything else of that until I got back to the shed where, we got back to the camp, and I started thinking of what was happening to this cement. And so, sure enough, we go there the next morning, and the bloke comes in 7:30 in the morning, and he's got a big wooden lever. He pulls it down, nothing happens, and then all the wiring, which was as old as the hills, his smoke coming. And then he's catching a light, and then the roof caught a light, and then the building caught a light, and then so they're very quick, these Germans, so they quickly ruled me and Harry in, and we was built, they took us away in this sort of Black Mariah thing, and as we drove away, the roof collapsed into this factory in a shower of sparks, and everybody was cheering. And I was having a funny feeling going around in my stomach. And I thought, but Harry, he showed him something there a bit, haven't we? I thought, yeah. So we go in front of this geezer who's got all this silver medals and braid. And so we're going to get sent away to Dresden to this little sort of Straflager, and they're going to get shooters in the morning, put us against the wall, sabotage. So Harry's still taking the mickey out of this bloke, and I'm trying to kick him. I thought, well, you know, it's not a very good position to be in. I was worried. I was really worried for the first time in my life. So I thought, well, this is it. I've gone too far this time. So I was bit and think, couldn't see any way out. So he goes into this building, locked away, full up. It was like there's many people in here as was in this place. There was two big 40-gallon vats, a neighbour full of excrement and stuff like that. And then went, anyway, we wasn't in there. We got in there at 3 o'clock. And that night, at 10 o'clock, over they came. And that was it. And that was the 13th of February. And three quarters of the way through the first raid, it's a big sort of bomb landed outside the building, blew all the building in. And blew me right over the other side, covered in brickwork and anything. I was, you know, out for the count, and Harry was dead. Harry was killed by the blast. He never had a mark on his body, except that everything inside him was pumped out by the blast. So anyway, after about 3 minutes, I recovered and made me through the rubble, found Harry, covered him up, and then got out into the furnace.
What happened then?
Oh, bloody will run out, mate. Isn't it? What?
No, go on. What happened then in the furnace?
Well, you're in the middle of this whacking. This is the first raid, which is sort of hors d'oeuvres. They're not dropping the big 4,000 pounders yet. They're dropping high explosive, and they're dropping incendiaries by the thousand. And they're all coming down like meter long sticks. Whatever they're made of, I don't know. But before the factory was blown in, we had a glass roof like a cupola. Because it made me think that this building in Peacetime had been a library. And a batch of these things come down right through the glass roof, and they landed on all these lads who were below it, because that's what it's like, crowded, see? So they're all caught alight, and you can't put it out. However much you tried, you couldn't put this stuff out. So they burnt to death. And what was happening... Outside, once we got outside, those of us were lucky and, you know, were able to get outside, you're surrounded by this, like this wall of fire on all sides. It's all burning. Everything's burning. Anything that can burn is burning. So, and I had these wooden clogs on. And it's the only reason I'm here today is because I was able to stand on the ground with these wooden clogs. If I'd had little thin, like leather soles, they'd have gone right, the heat would have gone through them. Although what it was like in the first raid, as I said, was easy. You wasn't really aware of the terrible things that were going to happen after the second raid, because the first raid finished after about an hour. The rest of the stragglers had gone, and the all clear goes. And after a time, those people that are left start crawling out of the rubble of there, start looking around, and everything's alight. There's nothing, you can't take cover from anything, no, it's impossible. And they said, and they're all old people. There are women with their little kids and old people. There's not a soldier in sight. Nothing. So by this time, this little group I was with, we'd found our way out of the debris, and it was on this sort of area where there's it was an open space. So, after about an hour, the flieger alarm goes again, and the second wave come over. And this time, you could see these things dropping, because they were huge. And once they hit the ground, anything within about 200 or 300 yards was immediately incinerated. And then to feed all this fire, all the air started to be built, and this is where the second raid was different from the first, because then you had these, say, 200 or 300 mile winds, which were being drawn into this, and in the centre of Dresden, where we were, all the fire and the conflagration, all the bits and pieces, anything that could be, wasn't bolted to the ground, was drawn up into this pyre of smoke and flame, including all these people, the women and kids, women holding their little kids, and they're all alive. You can't do nothing about it, and they're screaming and things. Anyway, after a time, after the second raid had finished, this gang of Germans appeared, and there was a bloke. There's one bloke, all had helmets on except one bloke. He had a cap. So I thought, well, he's a governor, and he sees a group of us and he eyes us up. And he sorts us out. Out of the 8 or 10 of us that were there, he picked about 5 of us, because he thought that we was big enough to wield a shovel or a pick or a crowbar. So we became part of his gang. He was a firefighter. He was a fireman. He wasn't a soldier, he was a fireman. And the first thing he wants to do is get back into the furnace and start digging out these people out of their shelters. Because he could only go so far because it was too hot, see? You couldn't breathe. But anyway, that was what he done for 5 days. And so that 5 days we spent opening up these never felt. There was only one shelter we opened up. What we found, four ladies and 3 young kids who were huddled up in this underground passage. And we brought them out, and we was all dancing and clapping each other, and Germans and me, all sorts of people, you know, I don't know. They spoke different languages, I don't know. But it seemed that that group was all one person, in the fact that we'd brought these women out, and we never found anybody else. No, they were the only people that we...
What did you find, Vic, in the shelter?
Well, when you open the door, the big ones... You don't see, there wasn't any bodies, no skeletons. Well, there were skeletons, but he didn't. But it was because what had happened, in some cases, merciful casting, the people had died through lack of oxygen. So they'd more or less fallen asleep, although they were still roasted, but they'd fallen asleep. But other cases where they were actually like, you put a leg of lamb in the oven, and that's what they were. They were in an oven and they couldn't get out. They'd locked the doors from the outside, so the wardens who used to walk around, and to stop them getting too many people in. And of course they were trapped inside them. So they were, and in this biggest one, the biggest one that we opened up had 5,000, supposed to have had 5,000 in. There was nobody left in there. There was just a sort of a glutinous mass all over the floor. So this lad, who I called him the general, he loved it, the general. I called him General. Hi, General.
Vic.
Yeah, you're General.
Vic.
And he said, give me this big crowbar. And when he more or less saw what was inside, he pulled me back. He said, more or less in German English, he said, no need to go in there. No good. He called me Tommy. No need to go in there, Tommy. He says, we know what it's like. No, we don't want to see it.
I'm going to interrupt there, Vic, because we're running out of time. And before we ask, I don't think there's going to be time for questions. But just tell me and tell everybody, how did that affect you? All those things that you've just so moved.
Well, Dresden affected me in so much that up to that point, although I'd been right the way through the war, and I'd seen blokes killed and things like this, it was Dresden which turned me from a normal person, a person who didn't give a monkey, who thought that it turned me into what I've now realised, that I was a psychological wreck. I was a psychopath. They turned me in. I couldn't. Anybody who tried to tell me what to do, any authority, and I would be up against them. Anybody who disagreed with me, I'd be up against them. Anything I didn't understand, I'd be up against them. And in some cases, it was quite brutal. And the thing is that you don't know you're doing it. You don't know. You think you're just a normal bloke. And blokes would say, well, you know, what, he's Frieda's old man, isn't he? Yeah, because Frieda was my wife. Yeah, one of them paratroopers, bonkers. And yeah, that's what it was. And of course, what happened is that through my life, and then my first marriage lasted 20 years, or 22 years, I think. But it was just a trail of carnage, misbehaviour, anything against authority. I left a wake of catastrophe everywhere I went. And I never knew what it was all about. All I wanted was peace and quiet. And I could never find it. I took all sorts of jobs. I took up cycling. Anything which would keep me active. Anything which would keep me active 24 hours a day so that your mind didn't go back. Because what happened in the end was that... the marriage broke down, and it was all my fault. No two ways about it. I broke up a marriage, and I lost three children. And actually, I haven't lost them all. One of them's here now. But and this is what this syndrome, this post-traumatic syndrome, is all about. And the person who's affected is living two lives, a right old Jekyll and Hyde existence. His right hand doesn't realise what his left hand is doing, and when he does, he wonders why the right hand, which is a good hand, can't overcome the bad hand. You're completely lost. And it goes on for years. That's what Soldier Spy is all about. Now, soldiers, the spy part about it, I don't know whether we've got enough time to go into that.
No, you have. The trouble is, there is a lot more to this story. The whole of Vic's post-war life. What I wanted you to hear was the trauma and the catastrophe that informed the next 40 years of Vic's life. We've just got time, Vic, for you to tell what happened when you went to Coventry. We've got 2 minutes to tell what happened at Coventry Cathedral last year.
A couple of years ago it was now, and I'd got involved with the Dresden Trust, or they got involved with me. And I had a letter from the Dean of Coventry. They hold a memorial service every Friday the 13th, or on the nearest Sunday weekend to it. Would I go up there to Coventry and give a talk? So I thought, well, you know, I've never been in church. I don't go to church or anything. So I told him all that. He said, don't know about that. So I went up to Coventry. So the dean had gone to Coventry, so I got his understudy. So I said to him, what do you want me to do? He said, I want you to get up there in the pulpit and talk for about 20 minutes about Dresden. So I goes up the steps. Well, finally get up there because they're a bit steep. And I'm looking around this, the cathedral was full up, absolutely full up it was. And so I gives forth. The next thing I know is that people are crying. And so at 20 minutes I thought, I've had enough of this. I've had enough, I've finished. See? So I tell them all about what it's all about. And at the end, they have a session where there's German people in the audience and English people, and they're all holding hands with each other and they're pledging themselves to eternal peace, which is a good thing in its way, if it could ever occur. And then this old German lady come up to me, and she was nearly as old, I don't know whether she was as old as me, but she looked it. but she put her arms around me, she put her arms around me and started crying away. And I was holding her. In the end, this dean, or he's come and parted us. And it was that time then that I realised that at last that something had happened to me where that my mind was clear again and I'd recovered. I don't put that down to anything to do with Christianity or believing God or anything like that, but it was just the fact that I felt at one with this old girl who I never knew, I'll never see again, that what had happened is that she was a young girl that night and she'd gone to see one of her friends who lived on the edge of Dresden, and her family were in the middle, and of course that was it, they were dead.
And that, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Vic, is as far as we can go now, because we've hit the end of this session. As I say, there's a lot more I could have asked Vic. I didn't ask any questions because I thought you'd rather hear this firsthand. It really breaks you up, just what happened. And all I can say is, Vic, Greg, on this 100th anniversary of the Somme, another terrible war, thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.